As we continue to celebrate and work through our study of Advent, I want you to think about for a minute the difference between the expression of Christmas and the experience of Christmas. There's a difference between the expression of Christmas and the experience of Christmas. The movies and the songs and the stories of the Christmas season project a time of unending joy and warmth and laughter. And while those characteristics do exist, you only have to live so long to also experience the sorrow and the weariness and the tears that this season can also bring. There's a difference between the expression of Christmas and the experience of Christmas, and we don't always know what to do with that. We feel the tension of that when you see the photos and the video of the devastating destruction in Western Kentucky. You feel the tension of that because you know there's so much sorrow at a time when there's supposed to be so much joy. That there's families gathering together to grieve and to rebuild when they're supposed to be gathering together to celebrate and enjoy each other. But we also feel this even outside of catastrophic events like that. Because many of you mourn the loss of loved ones that are no longer at your family gatherings. Maybe this is the first year without them at Christmas. And whether it was soon or a long time ago, that sorrow never really goes away. Some of you are anxious about the relational dysfunction, the relational conflict that this season amplifies in your family or with your friends. Others of you are frustrated that your life doesn't look like you envisioned it would. Your health or your job or your relationships or just your outlook. And you come to Christmas, the Christmas season, and you hear these happy songs and these happy movies, and you just feel that tension and that mix in your heart and don't know what to do with that. And I think what this boils down to is the way our weariness and our confusion and our fears lead us to feel like God is absent at the very time of year that we're supposed to feel like He's present. And we don't know what to do with that. From our perspective, certain circumstances in life can cause a gap between the expression of God with us and the experience of God with us. What do we do with that? What do we do when we sing songs that say, Emmanuel, God with us, He has come, He is here, there's hope, there's joy, there's peace. But it doesn't really feel like that. It's not my experience right now. Well, as we follow the storyline of the Bible, we will find the people of God experiencing that same gap. And we also find God speaking truth into that gap. Truth that you and I need today. So turn with me to Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah 51. If you want to use one of those blue Bibles in front of you, it's on page 611. Isaiah 51. And as you're turning there, let me just catch us up, because we've been taking big jumps throughout this Advent season. We started a few weeks ago looking at the story of creation, and that without creation, there is no Christmas. Without God with Adam and Eve in the garden, there is no God with us at Christmas time. And then we jumped forward many, many, many years, and Pastor Ryan preached on the story of Abraham and the covenant, and how we saw God with us in God's covenant with Abraham, that He promised to make Abraham a blessing to the nations. And then we moved forward, and last week, Pastor Rick preached on the story of the Exodus, where you can see God's presence isn't with His people the same way it was with Abraham or the same way it was with Adam and Eve, but His presence is still with His people. And He rescues them out of Egypt. And what happens after that is they enter the promised land under Joshua, not under Moses. Moses and his generation did not get to go into the promised land because of their sin. But under the leadership of Joshua, they enter the promised land and they're living there. But after Joshua dies, they raise up judges to lead the people. This is not a highlight in the history of the people of God. You read through the book of Judges, it is a messy book. And then eventually they raise up kings. They want to be like the other nations. We want a king like the other nations. And so God raises up Saul, and then God raises up David. And there's this whole line of kings that come to rule Israel. Some are good, most are not, and lead the people of God away from God. And it's during the period of the kings, specifically King Uzziah and King Hezekiah, that the prophet Isaiah speaks and lives. And what he's speaking to is that the people of God are about to experience God's judgment because they have rebelled against God over and over and over, and they've worshipped other gods over and over and over, and God is about to send them into exile. The empire of Babylon is about to come and take the people of Israel captive and take them into exile. And Isaiah is speaking into that about to happen. And here's what he says in Isaiah chapter 51, verse 1. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah who bore you, for he was but one when I called him, that I might bless him and multiply him. For the Lord comforts Zion. He comforts all her waste places and makes her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the voice of song. Give attention to me, my people, and give ear to me, my nation, for a law will go out from me, and I will set my justice for a light to the peoples. My righteousness draws near, and my salvation has gone out, and my arms will judge the peoples. The coastlands hope for me, and for my arm they wait. Lift up your eyes to the heavens, and look at the earth beneath. For the heavens vanish like smoke, and the earth will wear out like a garment, and they who dwell in it will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will never be dismayed. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. Fear not the reproach of man, nor be dismayed at their revilings. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them up like wool. But my righteousness will be forever, and my salvation to all generations. Awake. Awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over? And the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. This is the word that God is speaking to his people as they prepare to enter exile and for them to carry with them into exile. Because in exile, this time of longing, this time of waiting, this time of hoping, God comforts his people with the promise of his presence, with the promise of God with us, even though it feels like he's absent. And the first thing I want us to look at when it comes to this is the past of his presence. The past of his presence. What God does here is he speaks through Isaiah to his people and he calls them to listen. Notice in verse 1, he says, listen to me. And this call is repeated down in verses 4 and 7. Those verses kind of mark out the three sections here if you just kind of want to have some mental markers from you. Verse 1, he says, listen to me. Verse 4, he says, give attention to me. Give ear to me. In verse 7, he repeats it again, listen to me. But notice who his audience is. Notice who it is he's talking to. He describes them in different ways in each one of those verses. He says in verse 1, listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord. In verse 4, he calls them my people, my nation. In verse 7, he calls them, you who know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. He's speaking to those among the people of God who were still trusting and obeying God, even though they've been taken away from all that was normal to them. They hope in God, but they feel like their hope has been postponed. They hope in God, but they feel like their hope has been deferred. Their hearts are disoriented. Their vision is blurred, and so to correct that, the Lord calls them to look back. When things in the present are not making sense, when the Lord's work and will are not clear in the present, the Lord calls us to look back, to remember the past. He says in verse 1 of chapter 51, "Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug." So he says, remember your beginning. Remember where you came from as a people. Remember your history. And then we see the beginning that he's talking about. He says in verse 2, "Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who bore you, for he was but one when I called him, that I might bless him and multiply him." He tells them, you exist as the people of God because of how I work through Abraham and Sarah. And this is, to my knowledge, one of the only times, if not the only time, Sarah is mentioned outside of the book of Genesis in the Old Testament. And that's completely on purpose. Because what God is bringing them to understand is he's telling them, I work through impossible circumstances. Then you remember Abraham, Sarah, he was one man. They were one couple. She was barren and could not have kids. They were both way advanced in years. But yet they grew into the nation of God's people through God's promises. He was but one when I called him, that I might bless him and multiply him. God says, I worked my good purposes through impossible circumstances then, and I will work my good purposes through impossible circumstances now. As you go into exile, Israel, I kept my promises then, I will keep my promises now. I was with you then, I am with you now, I will always be with you. The power of this for the people of God then, and the power of this for the people of God today, is the truth that our circumstances do not dictate who our God is. Your current situation, the current things that weigh you down this time of year, the current things that grieve you this time of year, they do not determine the success of God's promises. That's in God's hands, and only his hands. And God is using this story from the past to grow the faith of his people, to strengthen the faith of his people, to comfort them as they wait and wait and wait for the fulfillment of his promises. He says in verse 3, "For the Lord comforts Zion. He comforts all her waste places and makes her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the voice of song." Notice those phrases in verse 3, waste places, wilderness, desert. All those words, all those phrases refer to their experience in exile. There's no more like there was in Exodus, this pillar of cloud and fire that visibly led the people of God. There's no more manna coming down from heaven for the people of God to see the way God is providing for them. All that was left of God's presence was the temple, and when the Babylonians came in to take them captive, that was destroyed. Everything they saw around them in exile reminded them of their loss. Everything they saw around them reminded them, it communicated to them, God's promises seem to have failed. God's not with you anymore. You don't have any visible expression of his presence anymore. But God promises that he's going to turn their wilderness into Eden. This takes us all the way back to what we saw in week 1. And this is the first hint, I think, in this passage that God is talking about a lot more than just exile. He's talking about a lot more than just the people of God in that day. He's leading us to recall the past and show us that the God who brought the world into existence, the God who worked his power through Abraham and Sarah, that God will have no problem restoring the ruins of this world into a place of joy and gladness and thanksgiving and singing. And it's not just about the Lord returning it into a place of beauty and plenty and peace like Eden was. It's about the Lord promising to do a work that wipes out the curse of sin from this world. It's about the Lord promising to do a work that wipes out sin and death and sickness and sadness from this world. And not only has he proven in the past that he will do this, he's also the only one with the power to do it. And that's the next thing, the power of his presence. The power of his presence. Look what he says in verse 4. Another call for them to listen, to pay attention. Verse 4, give attention to me, my people, and give ear to me, my nation, for a law will go out from me, and I will set my justice for a light to the peoples. My righteousness draws near, my salvation has gone out, and my arms will judge the peoples. The coastlands hope for me, and for my arm they wait. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Look at the earth beneath, for the heavens vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment, and they who dwell in it will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will never be dismayed. So when he calls them in verse 4 to give attention, to pay attention, to listen closely, he's directing their attention from their current circumstances to the reality of his presence. This is not, hey, you just need to deny how hard this is and forget how hard your life is. That's not what he's saying. But rather, he wants to show that his powerful presence is just as current as their circumstances. His powerful presence is just as current as their suffering and as their struggles. He says in the second part of verse 4, a law will go out from me. I will set my justice for a light to the peoples. He's saying that God is going to establish a new kingdom. His people were in a foreign kingdom. They were in Babylon. But God's saying, I promise to restore you to a new kingdom. And he says, I will set my justice. He's going to bring justice. Now, the opposite of justice in the context of this chapter is not just injustice. That's part of it. But I think the whole flow of this chapter helps us to understand that the opposite of justice is more broadly chaos. Things are not right. Things are not orderly the way God ordered them when he created the world. And we see that all over the place around us. We see that in our own hearts, don't we? So when he says, I'm going to set my justice, he's promising, I'm going to rescue creation from the chaos caused by sin, and I'm going to restore my good purposes. I'm going to right every wrong that exists in this world. And what he's promising is to move all of this closer to the restoration of God with us. Again, this is about more than just the rescue from exile. It's about more than that. Because when he says in verse 15, sorry, not verse 15, verse 5, he says, my righteousness draws near, my salvation has gone out, and my arm will judge the peoples. The coastlands hope for me, and for my arm they wait. That reference there to God's arm is a reference to his power to deliver, his power to rescue, his power to deliver and save his people. And he says, the coastlands hope for me. This is how I know this is about more than just exile, because if this was just about the people of Israel being rescued out of Babylon, what do the coastlands care about that? Why does it matter to, I think coastlands could also be in the ends of the earth. But why do the ends of the earth care that the people of Israel are rescued out of Babylon? Why would they hope for that? Well, it's about something much bigger than that. Because Israel's main problem was not exile. Israel's main problem is the same problem as the whole world. Every person then, every person now, you and me. The problem that we are separated from God because of our sin against him. So this is about much more than just relocating back to Israel. This is about being restored to a relationship with God. And for them to be saved from Babylon, but not to be saved from their sin, is a completely insufficient salvation. They groaned under the oppression of a foreign ruler. And today, all creation groans under the rule of sin in this world. The ache you feel at Christmas time because you know things aren't the way they're supposed to be is evidence of this. The grief and struggle and sorrow that just won't go away is evidence of this. The dark cloud of sin that pervades our lives is evidence of this. We sang earlier in the service, from our fears and sins, release us. There's this longing, there's this groaning. God, rescue us from this. Release us from the bondage of the curse of sin in this world. But then we see this reference in verse 4 where he said, I will set my justice for a light to the peoples. The word light is a really key word in the book of Isaiah. And you've heard it before in a verse that's very common around Christmas time. Back in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, where Isaiah says, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. For to us a child is born. To us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. This global, eternal salvation that God is going to accomplish will begin to unfold on this quiet, lonely night in Bethlehem, when the birth of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, takes place, because he is Emmanuel, God with us. Again, God is bringing comfort to his sorrowful people here. And he's filling in the gap between the expression of God with us and the experience of God with us. And he's not just doing that for them, but also for us today. Only his presence has the power to sustain us in the midst of the hardships of life. Only his presence and his promises are strong enough to uphold us when all of life around us feels like it's crumbling. And this connects us to our final point this morning, the permanence of his presence. The permanence of his presence. Look with me at verse 7. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. Fear not the reproach of man, nor be dismayed at their revilings. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. But my righteousness will be forever, and my salvation to all generations. For the people of God that Isaiah was speaking to, the joy and the rest of the promised land had been replaced by the insults and the force of the evil nation that had taken them captive. The presence of God no longer overwhelmed their senses like it did back in the day. The presence of God no longer was right in front of their face like it was for earlier generations of God's people. Their perception of his presence was weak, and it would have been tempting that God's just absent altogether. That God with us has now been replaced by God's not with us anymore. But in verse 7, the Lord encourages them not to be afraid of those that are against them, not to be alarmed by those that threaten their peace and hope in this world. But why? Why does he tell them that? Why shouldn't we fear? Why shouldn't we be dismayed by the brokenness of this world that we see all around us? He says in verse 8, the end of verse 8, the moth will eat them up like a garment, the worm will eat them like wool, but my righteousness will be forever, my salvation to all generations. He says, don't be dismayed by the darkness of this world, but hope, because there's something more permanent than the darkness. Don't be distraught by the evil and brokenness of this world, because it won't last, but my salvation will last. Brokenness and sin and sadness and sorrow is not permanent, but the salvation of God is permanent. The experience of exile for the Israelites would have caused them to question the permanence of God's promises. They come into exile, they're taken captive into Babylon, and they look around and just think, okay, do these promises really last? Is God really going to follow through with what we've been taught over and over and over? And we feel that in circumstances that the Lord brings us in. God's promise is true here because the darkness sure seems to overwhelm the light right now. But the Lord speaks into our doubt, and the Lord speaks into our uncertainty with the truth that if we don't want to place our trust in the permanence of God's promises, then what do we suggest we put in their place? What's more permanent? What's going to last? It can't be anything in this world, because he says it's all going to be eaten up like a moth eating a garment. It's all going to be eaten up like a worm eating wool. There's nothing compared with the permanence of God's promises. My righteousness will be forever, God says. My salvation to all generations, it never goes away. The light of God's salvation will outlast the darkness of this world. His salvation will outlast the storms of your life. His salvation will outlast cancer. His salvation will outlast disaster. His salvation will outlast death. His salvation will outlast addiction. His salvation will outlast conflict. His salvation will outlast war. His salvation will outlast every sin in your heart. The reality of God with us will outlast the experience of thinking maybe He's not with us. And though His presence may seem far, His work is always near, I promise you, because He promises that. And just because He's hidden from our view does not mean His promises have failed. His promises do not move forward based on what you and I know and see. His promises move forward based on what He knows and sees. And you and I need to trust that what He knows and sees is more trustworthy than what we know and see. His promises are permanent. His presence with His people is permanent. His salvation is permanent. And He shall by His word dispel all the darkness in the universe. So after God recounts the past and the power and the permanence of His presence, His exiled people respond. They hear Him talk about salvation, and it causes them to think about the key event of salvation in the Old Testament, the Exodus. And as they think about that, they cry out for God to take action. God, we've heard what you did then. Do that now. Do that again. Deliver us from our enemies like You did for Your people in the days of Moses. So you hear them respond in verse 9. They say, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O armor of the Lord. Awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not You who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon?" It's a reference to Egypt and God rescuing His people out of Egypt. "Was it not You who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over?" So the people remember, they're remembering the past, and they say, "God, we saw You do that. We heard about You doing that. Can You do that again? Are You awake? Are You asleep? Because it sure feels like that's not going to happen." And I think where we see the link between them and us is how we hear the combination in their words of both longing and hope, both doubt and faith. They're trapped in their hard circumstances. They are in exile, but the story of God has instilled hope in them. And that flame hasn't been completely blown out in their hearts. Because they say in verse 11, after God, "Didn't You do this? And didn't You do this? And didn't you do this?" They say in verse 11, "And the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." They say, "Lord, we want to see the fulfillment of Your promises. We want the Messiah to come. For now, we don't know when that's going to happen, but we know it will, and we know that when it does, joy and gladness will overwhelm all our sadness and all our sorrow." They expect this greater exodus to happen, this greater rescue to happen, when light pierces the darkness, when salvation conquers sin, when restoration replaces brokenness, when heaven invades earth. And it's all going to start centuries later when a young girl gives birth to a baby boy and they call his name Jesus. The people of God in Isaiah's day long for Jesus to come. And as was mentioned earlier in this service, the people of God today, we long for Him to come back. And until that day, there's going to be a difference between the expression of Christmas and the experience of Christmas. That gap will not go away. Until that day, certain circumstances in life will create a gap between the expression of God with us and the experience of God with us. But until that day, His promises and His presence through Jesus fill that gap for us. The Lord is calling us to Isaiah through Isaiah 51. And He's calling us to say, through your tears and through your grief and through your sorrow, rejoice. Rejoice. Because Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. He's going to come back. I'm going to pray, and we're going to continue to reflect on this as we celebrate the Lord's Supper together.